Yes, don't get it. Everybody's pants in an uproar. That was the sound of a cigarette being lit. All right, now after everybody's collective heart attacks, that really wasn't a cigarette. That was just a lighter being lit. Canada Day. You know, I've shared with you before that my taste for life cycle events, be they personal or societal, is very low, and my threshold for tolerance is very low. But the hypocrisy on Canada Day, particularly galling part of it, is we try and celebrate all those things from our past. Should keep celebrating every day of our lives. A vision for this country. Courage. We trot out veterans while we make fun of them the rest of the time. While we negate the military. While we negate vision. We try to be all things to all cultures without putting forward a Canadian mythology except one day in the year. I don't know about you, but this kind of hypocrisy just turns my stomach. We've become a society that doesn't stand for anything. If you don't stand for something, you're going to fall for anything. Question for today is, what's the point of Canada Day? Canadians seem ready to give up the consequence of their own individual sovereignty over their government for any kind of law that controls everything we do, from what we eat, our private morality and our private domain, our access to our elected officials. We don't seem to care, as long as we get another $34 and some kind of government check. So why go through this charade? Prime Minister Harper is first leader in 15 years that tried to give us some vision of what this country stands for. And he's been lambasted in the so-called liberal press and the chattering classes for actually saying the Canadians are capable of courage. The Canadians don't cut and run. So Canada's going to have to make up its mind what kind of a country it is. And Canadians are going to have to make up their mind what they really believe in. Or are they just a bunch of hypocritical pansies, willing to follow any state dictate just to have a bit of security and to follow any kind of orthodoxy, no matter how wrong and how stilted, just to avoid any government oversight? That's what we're going to discuss for the first half hour today with a very special guest. What is Canadian consequence? Does it mean anything anymore? And where are we going to be in 10 years? We may be nowhere. Because we're moving toward a time and toward a government, unless this newly elected government can change it, that the state that's exhibited such a lack of trust in the people and seeks to dominate through suffocating rule and regulation that Canadians seem to just accept readily, has embarked on a road to social fascism. Yeah, social fascism, that's what you can call it. That's what this country may be at all levels. And our response in what could be the waning dusk of real freedom may have to be the responsible agitation of civil disobedience. We're heading toward a time when Albert Camus' line about a society arriving at a point where just being human makes you heroic. That's the time we may be living in now. You know what? If you want to breathe free, if you want to live free, you may have to start being human. Feels really good to be heroic. We'll be back with our first guest after this. Canada, we want to hear from you about Canadian consequence. Is there any left? 790-0060@iapm.ca. I want to read you something that our first guest wrote, a wake-up call that all Canadians should hear, and I'm just going to read a bit of it. Canadians are proud to call themselves the most moderate of people. Tolerance has become their vocation, a kind of raison d'etre, the breath of their ambition. This isn't your father's Canada anymore. They wouldn't recognize it. The nation roams around under a cloud of amnesia as if nothing happened before yesterday. Canada offers security and anonymity, but demands conformity and equanimity. What we have is a virtual country. For the most part, multiculturalism is our Bible, a kind of narcissism for Canadians. No one teaches Canadian history anymore. Captured by the canons of political correctness, schools celebrate multiculturalism as an end in itself, failing to teach the superiority of civic nationalism over ethnic nationalism. And in a voiceless country, no one speaks for Canada anymore. Everybody comes here, lives their lives happily in their own languages, importing their own prejudices and struggles too, which often find violent expression in grim urban corridors. But as the country changes, you can't talk about that. Can't talk about much of anything. The writer of these words is Andrew Cohen, professor of journalism and international affairs at Carleton University and the author of While Canada Slept, How We Lost Our Place in the World. You need to get this book. Andrew Cohen, thanks for joining us on Sunday.
Thank you.
Remarkable words. It's the piece is called A Virtual Country, and this was written as part of a project with coming out of a conference called Canada 2020, but as part of a project of the Toronto Star, La Presse, the Dominion Institute, and the CBC. And I would urge everybody to go to thestar.ca or cyberpress.ca and see this. Andrew Cohen, when did Canada lose its way?
I think we lost our way probably about a generation ago. In my last book, I talk about all the things we used to do in the world. We were the world's leading peacekeeper. We were a warrior with great effect in the First and Second World Wars and in Korea.
We actually had twice as many men and women under uniform as a percentage of population as America did.
Not only that, but for a small country, we took enormous casualties. In the First World War, we sent we lost some 60,000 Canadians, and in the Second World War, 40,000, and we've left 100,000 Canadians in foreign fields. We did that in Korea as well. We got away from that. Our diplomacy, our foreign service was once called by John Kennedy, but just before he became president, the finest in the world. We were a leader in developmental aid. We were there in Colombia when the Colombo Plan was organized and created. We had a voice in the world, and we got away from that about a generation ago. And it's taken us some years now to realize where we are. I think we may be now realizing that. Just this week, the Harper government, as you know, Beryl, announced a major purchases for our military,
yes,
which will allow us to project power across the world. This is the first big thing we've done in a long time, and the government deserves some credit for it.
Yes, yes, it does, and this is you anticipated my next question. In my introduction to this theme today, I said that the Harper government, and the Prime Minister particularly, maybe the first in 15 years, if not longer, to actually try to give us a vision. Can he succeed in light of the chattering classes and the kind of institutionalized neutrality that's taken over Canada?
Well, Beryl, you mentioned cutting and running, and you'll remember that the Prime Minister went to Afghanistan in February, very early into his new government, after his election in January. And one of the things he said is, you know, Canadians don't cut and run. Canadians have a reputation for staying in a place, finishing the job, and he committed ourselves to Afghanistan. And those were all fine words, and I hope the Prime Minister is right, but he's talking about a Canada which is very, very different from the one in which a Prime Minister may have spoken those words, say, 50 years ago.
He's speaking about a Canada that he hopes to recreate.
Yes, and I hope he's successful, but we're untested as a nation in 2006, and what our commitment is in Afghanistan is uncertain. We have not been in combat essentially since Korea, and that was a much different country. So I'm hoping that Canadians, who public opinion shows seem to be behind the Afghanistan commitment, but I'm hoping when Mr. Harper talks about a country which endures, which has courage, which believes in certain things and is ready to put its money where its mouth is, and its military where its mouth is, frankly, because this is a matter of arms and men and women, I'm hoping that he's speaking to a country which believes that. I think he is, but it's untested. And, of course, Afghanistan, which is only a small part of the Canadian reality today, will be tested if indeed we have casualties there. We have had some, but I mean, if they get worse than they are or more than they are.
How do we address the Canadian mythology and a particular aspect of the Canadian myth, the negative myth? For example, I'll speak on just, I want your answer to two issues. We like to talk of ourselves as peacekeepers, yet the reality is we're behind Bangladesh on any measure of peacekeeping, total men, total missions, total hours. We like to talk about what we do in foreign aid, yet we've never reached the Personian the level of 0.7% of our GNP as in foreign aid. In fact, we're behind most other countries. But more than anything, third point, do you think Canadians are ready to understand that as a G7 nation benefiting so much from the cheap labor and cheap resources of third world countries, of failed states, that we at least have an obligation to participate in the democratic development, the efforts for democratic development, the transcendent yearning for redemptive change of people and offer people hope in coalition with other like-minded traditional allies? Are we ready to accept that, or do we just want to take and take and take and think social justice stops at our borders and I'm all right, Jack?
Well, I'm hoping we would accept that obligation because we have done that. One of the things that you mentioned, Beryl, is that we've we've been essentially cut off from our past. I teach at a university, and I have very bright students, but they don't know what Canada did a generation ago. You know, the Second World War is ancient history to them.
So is
Vietnam and Korea. Not that we were involved in Vietnam, but we certainly were in Korea, and they don't know. When I asked them who Lester Pearson was and how Canada won the Nobel Prize in 1957 for our efforts...
Blank stares.
That's right, blank stares. So one of our challenges as a nation, and this is true in most provinces, is we have to tell Canadians what they are. And we have to tell new Canadians the country to which they're coming and settling. That's part of our challenge. And when I talk about civic nationalism, I mean finding ourselves in our laws, our principles, and our past, and who we are as a people, who we were as a people, and how we may be that again if we have a very strong sense of what we ought to do in this world. We've been talking about what we can do in the world. All those things you said are true. We do have a mythology about what we are doing in the world today. We still think, most Canadians think we're very generous. We actually aren't compared to other nations. Most Canadians think that we have only been peacekeepers. We were peacekeepers. We're not doing it anymore. But they also deny we were ever warriors. They have no knowledge.
And that's not a dirty word.
No, it isn't a dirty word when you're fighting against fascism and Nazism as we did proudly and honorably and successfully and effectively in the Second World War. We were effective then. We had the military we needed, and we had that military up until the 1960s. Then we got away from that. Now, we were peacekeepers into the late 80s, and in fairness to ourselves today, while we are not in peacekeeping anymore, we are in Afghanistan, and we should give ourselves credit for that. There are 2,300 Canadians in Afghanistan. We have some left in Bosnia. But the Afghanistan commitment is among the leading commitments today in that field. So I think we have to give ourselves credit for that. And that wasn't just this conservative government. That was embraced by the last Liberal government. So we are, I think, attempting, when I wrote about While Canada Slept, I'm hoping that in some ways we are awakening today, but we are still far from what we ought to be doing.
Andrew Cohen, hold that thought. We'll be right back with you after we pay some bills, and we're going to discuss Canada's institutional memory, 790-0006. We'll be right back after this. And we're talking about Canadian consequence. We're talking about institutional memory. Listeners, do you feel anything? What matters to you? Do you understand the role of a democracy should be in the world? Or are you just worried about your quarter acre of land, I'm all right, Jack, and social justice stops at our borders? Or Andrew Cohen, All Canada Slept, it's a book you need to read. And you made 2 points in our last segment. And I want to address the second first, the institutional memory. What do Canadians remember? And you said about, you described how you talked to your students when you gave your classes, how little they remember. And here in Quebec, there is they could come up with a new history text that absolutely whitewashed history. No Louis-Joseph Papineau emancipating all minorities 20 years ahead of England. No Louis Lafontaine's responsible government. No Lac-Megantic labor strife that brought down or that helped to bring down retrograde government. And, you know, I do a lot of work with some FTQ unions. When I go down to their headquarters and I speak to young organizers and you say the name Jean Marchand, the first reaction is, Vendu, Dieu, sellout. But when you speak to 65-year-olds, they remember Lac-Megantic. How do we recreate that authentic Canadian institutional memory?
Well, we have, and when I listen to you, Beryl, it saddens me. You're not telling me anything new, but it saddens me when they don't remember the name of Jean Marchand, a very proud Quebecer who was a Federalist, who entered politics with Pierre Trudeau and Gerard Peltier in 1965. They were called, you'll remember, Beryl, the Three Wise
Yes.
Men. And no less committed to democratic unions in Quebec and the working man. And it saddens me that they're called Vendu today. They had the best interests of Quebecers in mind in the 1960s and before. Pierre Trudeau marched with workers in the asbestos strike of 1948 when Quebec was a much different society than it is today. And that is part of the problem, Beryl. That's exactly the problem. We have a willful amnesia about our past. Simply have whitewashed or simply have chosen not to teach it. 6 of 10 provinces do not teach any Canadian history.
Amazing.
I'm not, you know,
this reminds me of the line from Daniel Patrick Moynihan once said during the debate at the UN in 1975 that everyone is entitled to their own opinions, but no one is entitled to their own facts, except we're not giving our young people facts.
No, we're not. And in Quebec, it's sad that Papineau and Lafontaine, who are celebrated today, you may be interested to know, his former Excellency John Ralston Saul, a Canadian writer, and was married to the former Governor General Adrian Clarkson,
yes,
sponsors a lecture every year, which takes place all across the country, called the Baldwin
Lafontaine Lecture.
Yeah. And one of them was, I believe, in Quebec City about a year ago, and Louise Arbour and others were there.
Sadly, it's always shown on CPEC.
Well, sadly it is, and there are people every day. The institute that has sponsored this series, in which I was the inaugural writer, the essay you referred to, is the Dominion Institute. It's based in Toronto, but it has branches across the country, and it's dedicated to the resurrection, so to speak, and the promotion of Canadian history. So how do we do it? We start teaching who we are again, and we do it honestly. When you tell me about what is being taught in Quebec, it kind of reminds me of the textbooks in Japan where I just spent some time. Which have whitewashed what Japan, what its role was in Asia and at Nanking, and I'm not comparing in any way what we've done and what they did, but I'm simply saying history is not taught because people don't want to deal in realities and in facts. And one of the things we have to overcome in Canada, which is a place of amnesia, is that we had a past. And it's not, when I say don't remember my students, it's not their fault. They weren't taught it. I mean, I don't expect them to remember things that they were not there to witness. You talked about those over 65. Yes, they remember Jean Marchand and others. What we have to do is continuously reintroduce Canadians to their past in an honest way. I don't mean to whitewash it. I mean to tell what we did well and what we didn't do well.
To make the Quebec slogan, Je me souviens, I remember, mean something for all of Canada.
That's right.
Andrew
That's
Pone,
right.
Thanks very much for being with us today. Have a good rest of the weekend.
My
While
pleasure,
Canada
man.
Slept, listeners, get this book and go to thestar.ca or cyberpress.ca and read this essay, A Virtual Country. Andrew, thanks again. We're back, Montreal. You can email me at info@iapm.ca. We want to know from you and hear from you. What can't you? Is this where you live and can you have an address? Do you understand the sacrifices of generations past? Do you understand the responsibility of freedom? We've become a nation, as George Bernard Shaw wrote, of people who are afraid, of people whose motto could be very well that line he wrote in one of his plays, liberty demands responsibility. That's why so many dread it. Do we dread being free? Do we dread remembering what our past was? Have we completely lost what our previous guest, Andrew Cohen, talked about as our institutional memory? And if we've lost that, how do we deal with the challenges going forward? We're going to talk about that with our next guest. Martin Petriquin is a Montreal journalist, who had a very interesting take on Canada's nationhood, but of course in any discussion of Canada's nationhood, there's Quebec's nationhood. And we've had a lot of talk about that. The Prime Minister, we did not want to use the word nation. Of course, then everybody jumped all over him and said, Quebec is a nation. But what is Quebec within Canada? And we've got some surprising new information and views on that that we're going to discuss with Martin. How are you, Martin Petriquin?
Pretty good. How are you, Beryl?
Okay. You wrote a fascinating article in the National Post this week. You had some conversations with some pur et dur souverainistes.
Yep.
Who gave you a kind of new spin on what would make them happy. Let's go over a little bit of that.
Okay, sure. Basically, what he said, this is a fellow named Jack Bergeron, who has been with the Société Saint-Jean-Baptiste for as long as he can remember anyway, and he said the last person he actually voted for federally was John Diefenbaker, and since then he's either abstained or voted bloc, and he basically said to me, and I was researching another story and I was talking to him about it, and he just happened to say this. He said, you know, if Canada put into the Constitution that Quebec is a French-speaking province and has laws protecting that fact, that he thinks that the separatist argument would become moot, more or less.
So his thing was language more than any kind of political expression on any other issue.
Yeah, it's for him, for this man, and I mean, I don't agree with him with his take on it, because he's still a nationalist, he wants the separation of Quebec, but but I respect the idea that the language has to be protected, particularly the French language, which is very small in a very big English ocean, as he put it.
Martin, we'll be right back with you. We're just going to pay some bills. Back right after this. When you call, we want to hear from you about what Canada means to you, and have you got the guts to fight for a kind of Canada that means something in the world? We're talking to Martin Patrickin, Montreal journalist who wrote a fascinating piece in the National Post this week on sovereigntists, hardline sovereigntists for years, who've put forward a suggestion, at least one of them did, of what could satisfy a lot of sovereigntists. Saying that, you know, let's protect the language and the rest will go away. What did he base that on? There's a lot of other things that sovereigntists want besides language protection. It can't all be about culture, is it?
Hello?
Martin?
Yeah, I'm here.
Sorry, we just had a technical break there. I was asking you, it can't all be about culture. There's Jacques Bergeron who suggested that putting language into the Constitution and protecting that, and that would be sufficient. Is he making the argument that it's all about just language and culture?
I don't think he thinks that that's the be-all and end-all, but that's the main one. That's the main sticking point. It's always for people like this. It's the survival of the language, and I think to a certain extent he has a point.
How widely is that opinion shared? Did he indicate to you?
Say it again.
How broadly is that opinion shared?
I think secretly, and I mean he sort of made a bit of a step coming out and saying this, but I think secretly I'd say. He was saying basically that you could get rid of 80% of what the problem is within Quebec and Canada just by doing that. And it's not a question of saying that we're distinct or special or anything. That
right.
It's just admitting the obvious. It's that Quebec's different.
That's always
been the case.
Is part of the reason for this a sort of disaffection among the sovereignty movement with the leadership of André Boisclair and the PQ? Is the fire petering out just because of lack of charismatic leadership that they were expecting from Boisclair?
I think they shot themselves in the foot by electing him. All the hardline sovereignists that I was talking to before the election were dreading the idea that he would come in and do this. Because I don't think he's beatable. I don't think he's winnable at the next election.
Did you get an impression at all from talking to Bergeron and some others that they are happy with anything that Canada has been doing to accommodate the protection of French culture in Canada and the French culture in Quebec and the status that Quebec has over so many areas of jurisdiction or shared status, including things like immigration?
Yeah, I think there's a selective myopia that's very convenient for a lot of separatists to ignore a lot of that. You tell the average Quebecer that actually Quebec has a large amount of say over who comes into the province just through their own immigration, like you just said, and people don't really realize that. To answer your question, I don't think that they have. I don't think there is that recognition as much as there should be.
It's interesting. You mentioned that Jacques Bergeron is a member. I don't remember if you had mentioned a former executive member of the St. Jean-Baptiste Society.
Well, he's current member of, he's president of the Members for Life section. So it's people that have membership for life, basically, that honor this. And, I mean, there's people like Gerard LaRose and Pierre Falardeau, and, you know, hardcore separatist people that have been in the movement forever and who are very adamant about it.
What's interesting about the SSJB is that since the year 2000, since Guy Boutillier's presidency, they've made a concerted effort at outreach to other communities. We had the affair recently where the head of their youth wing was accused of being a member of a right-wing youth group, and there was none of something that would have happened, let's say, even 10 years ago, where the leaders of the SSJB would say, oh, you know, this is some kind of an Anglo conspiracy to discredit us. They actually came out and said, we will not accept any membership by any of our people in any right-wing groups, in any racist groups, and there was none of that insecurity. It shows a sort of maturity of the movement.
Yeah, I wrote about that story, the skinhead side for McLean's magazine and looked into that. They tried to downplay it a little bit, but you're right, they came out and they did say that, and it wasn't blamed on Le Monde d'Anglais, which is usually what happens, used to happen in the past.
So maybe I'll go ahead. Sorry, Martin.
I was just going to say that, under less so under the current president, but under the former president, Guy Boutillier, you know, he was bringing in Anglo groups and traditionally Federalist groups, you know, like the Irish and right down to the Haitian communities, and bringing them into the Maison Duvernay there on Sherbert Street.
Yes.
Which was quite a step.
They even did great outreach to the Jewish community. On this candidate day, we may be seeing some kind of maturity even from some of the more nationalistic elements within the sovereignty movement.
Possibly. I think so, but I think there's still, I think as that happens, and as I think the youth wing business with the St. Jean Baptiste Society shows, is that as there's sort of an entente between the two sides, there is going to be that element of right wing, I don't know how to say it, but more extremism of people that want Quebec to be a country no matter what, regardless of anything that happens.
So despite everything else, there's a certain level of alertness is still called for. Martin Petitcat, thanks very much. Have a great weekend. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, bro.
We'll be right back after this, Montreal. Well, while we're deciding in Canada what Canada means to us as a nation, there's another democracy, a free nation, a freedom-loving nation, and knows the cost of that liberty and that independence. And see, and the only one, irony, in the middle rim of this planet from the borders of Pakistan to the Moroccan Atlantic coast, and that nation is Israel. And Israel this week is going through drone trials, attacked last week by a Hamas-sponsored and Hamas-led raid that resulted in the death of several soldiers, the kidnapping of another. Israel responded. Israel's understanding the consequences of its own nationhood and the need to protect that. And with us to discuss the response is Luciano Del Negro, Executive Director of the Quebec-Israel Committee. Welcome, Luciano. Thanks for taking the time out on a Sunday.
Thank you, Barrow, and good afternoon.
Luciano, one interesting thing to me, and I may be wrong, but it seems that this situation right now, putting aside the kidnapping of Gilad Shalit, we have a different kind of Israeli response to a different kind of problem. For years, every time Israel responded to the murder of its citizens by terrorist groups, we had a lot of the left-wing press, a lot of the chattering classes saying, well, Israel shouldn't do that, and Israel's neighbors really aren't supporting the terrorists. These are terrorists operating off the land of other nations. Well, this time, it was an operation by a group, Hamas, that is now the duly elected government of a political jurisdiction, I'll be careful with my phrases, attacking another sovereign political jurisdiction named Israel. In international law, Israel would have the right to do whatever it wants against that other jurisdiction that's claimed responsibility for this attack in the name of its own government. Well, is that not right?
Well, certainly. The Israeli government has the right to protect its citizen. But before we get on to that, Beryl, I simply, given that it's the day after Canada Day, simply I would like to state that it's a, you know, greetings to Master Bombardier Bunyart Tarnapon Mataparek, who was of the 30th Field Regiment in Ottawa, who was wounded in Afghanistan, simply to point out that sister democracy issues should support one another, and this is one of our soldiers who has been wounded in a conflict in defense of democracy,
right,
and to establish peace.
That's right.
So it is important to underline, and our greetings goes to his family and to his comrades in arms. And I think on this, I think people can certainly understand the incredible angst which Israelis are today living in, because in fact Ms. Gilad Shalit has been kidnapped and is being held by a terrorist organization. You've correctly pointed out that this is not simply one of the run-of-the-mill terrorist organization, but it was part, you know, the, one of the groups involved in it was Hamas, which in Hamas happens to be part of the government. Therefore, the Palestinian Authority must assume its share of responsibility for securing his safer return, and of course must assume the responsibility of what is happening. If for all those people who wish that peace that the situation comes to a fruitful, the ball is in the camp of the Palestinian Authority. They should simply release Gilad Shalit. Unfortunately, the situation in Gaza.
But Luciano, yes. it's more than Gilad Shalit. It's the idea. Let's say the attack on the fort, on the Israeli fortified outpost on Israeli soil, had not resulted in a kidnapping, just in sadly deaths of Israeli soldiers. This was an operation carried out in the name of Hamas. Hamas readily took credit, in quotations, for this operation. So now you have a sovereignly elected government of a political jurisdiction carrying out an attack on a sovereign nation. Doesn't this raise the stakes? Doesn't this raise the right of response to a different and new level for Israel?
Yes, yes, it does. It's a very threatening attack. I think it shows that what Hamas intention, it betrays Hamas's intention in terms of how it views its relationship with Israel. And quite and to simply put, they built a one close to 800 meter long tunnel from Gaza Strip into the State of Israel. Clearly, this
after attacking Israel with 1,000 Qassam rockets. This engagement, Luciano Del Negro, please stay with us. We'll be back with you right after the news to discuss another aspect of the situation in the Middle East. Montreal, we'll be back with you in a few moments. Israel's response this time on the part of a Hamas government. Where our guest is Luciano Del Negro, Executive Director of the Quebec Israel Committee, and we have Daniel calling in. Luciano, we'll just take one call. Daniel, good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon, Barry.
How you doing?
Not too bad. Listen, I just want to state the fact that I am not a Palestinian. I do not support whatever is going on in Palestine. I am not an Israeli. And I do not care a hoot about whatever is going on in Israel. The only support I have for Israel is because I'm a Christian, and I know that the Christian origins stand from the land of Israel. That's it. But what is happening currently...
But Daniel, would you hate me if I told you that the only reason I support Israel is not because of anything in the Bible, but because it's a democracy? And if it ever becomes a theocracy, I'm going to get very nervous.
Yes, but the fact that if Israel is a truly democratic state, then it has to follow the principles of democracy. The way Israel is acting in view of this kidnapping scenario, it is acting like a strong armed dictatorial.
Okay, but Daniel, follow my argument for a second. Follow my argument. What I just told Luciano Del Negro is the following, that this has nothing to do with the kidnapping. For this has to do with a government, Hamas, that got elected. Now, Hamas got elected. A government can't just have rights. It has to have responsibilities and take responsibilities. They planned the attack. Forget about the kidnapping. The attack on the Israeli outpost in Israel. They've been shooting 1,000 rockets into Israel by their own admission. Now, doesn't a sovereign government of a political jurisdiction have to take responsibility for attacks on another sovereign jurisdiction? For example, let's say that Canada was attacked by America. Wouldn't we have a right to strike back if we had anything to strike back with?
No. But
why?
As a democratic country,
what does democracy have to do with self-defense?
We don't want to accentuate the antagonism.
But Daniel, what does democracy have to do with self-defense?
Because
Israel was aggressed against, and this is what...
Self-defense is based on proper negotiation.
Well, why did the West...
You have to defend
why? When you're attacked, you're attacked. You have to... The primary responsibility of a country is to protect its citizens, democratic or not. Now, Canada, America, all the free world went to war in Korea. Korea never attacked itself. It went to war in Vietnam. This is a country that is being attacked by its neighboring state, Daniel. You got to get over this business. You got to get over the rest of the stuff about the Palestinians. It's a tragedy, and the refugees are a tragedy. But the reality is that Israel was the only country to recognize a Palestinian state in 1948, and the fact is that the only political jurisdiction that today that represents the Palestinians ordered, planned, and took responsibility for attack on a sovereign state. So you'd better, it takes responsibility. It cannot just have rights. Thank you, Daniel. We're getting back to Luciano. Luciano Del Negro, how are you?
Fine, thank you. Your point was well taken. Israel's actions are limited to the achievement of very clear objectives outlined by Olmert, namely the rescue of Gilad Shalit and the disruption of the terror infrastructure operating...
But you see, Luciano, let me ask you something, and you know, obviously we should, I had a number of issues, but on the public relations issue, and you just heard Daniel there.
Yes.
Everybody, it's like Israel's always held to a double standard. Yeah, it's a democracy, but it shouldn't defend itself against the attack from a state. What I'm saying to you is, even if there was no kidnapping, you've got now a higher level of responsibility on the part of Hamas. They can't just scream, we're refugees, we have to have rockets. They're a government, and they have to take responsibility for a government and suffer the consequences when they, as a government, attack another state.
Well, look, the international...
Why can't people get that? Right. Why do they hold Israel to another standard? If anybody attacked Canada, we'd expect our country to go crazy and attack back.
Precisely. The international community, led by the Quartet, has put three conditions to the Hamas government if it wishes to keep international legitimacy and continue to support financially. With his... he must recognize Israel's right to exist, stop all terrorist activities, and commit itself in carrying out all previous international agreements signed by the Palestinian Authority. Unfortunately, this organization is committed to the destruction of Israel, its charter calls for a holy war against all Jews, and the establishment of an Islamic state in all historic Palestine. Hamas views Jews together with the Freemasons as responsible for the French Bolshevik Revolution, so on and so forth.
Ah, the poor Freemasons. Luciano, hold the thought. We'll be right back after we pay a bill or two. Luciano Del Negro, Executive Director of Quebec Israel Committee, discussing response to the Hamas attacks on its territory.
Yes.
A novel twist on this with you, or a novel idea. To my mind, as we've been discussing, what Hamas did by sponsoring the attacks, by sponsoring the months of Qassam rocket attacks after Israel disengaged unilaterally from Gaza... Hamas, as a government of a political jurisdiction, and I want to be careful about what I say, has a heightened level of responsibility. And if it's treated at that heightened level as an attacker from one political jurisdiction against a sovereign state of Israel, it is culpable for every penalty that every other country, from England to France to Russia, has used against any country aggressing it. My question to you is this. The follow-up measure by Israel of arresting certain members of the Haniyeh government, though perfectly legal and under Israeli court warrants, does that not actually sort of bring annul a little bit the responsibility of this independent government? In other words, if you left them alone, and if Israel just whacked the shit out of them until the Hamas government accepted the existence of Israel, renounced violence... and treated them as the responsible administrative entity of a political jurisdiction, they would be liable to higher retribution. But when you go and you arrest them, you're almost saying, well, you're sort of quasi-responsible. Does that demean their responsibility a little bit? Does that lessen it?
I don't think that is the case. The arrest of Hamas operatives, they arrested about 100 members. Who have violated laws pertaining to the prevention of terrorism.
I'm not talking about the rest of the members. I'm talking about the arrest of the cabinet officials.
Yes. But likewise, many of these people were involved in one way or another, directly or indirectly, in terrorist activities. For a past number of years, Israel has always been incredibly mindful of intervening in such a way as to limit casualties.
But that's what I'm saying. Why be so mindful? Why be so polite?
Because
they are responsible for murder. In other words, what I'm saying to you, and wait till the calls are about to start coming in. What I'm saying is, if Israel bombed these guys in their cars, that is a perfectly normal response to an act of war against a sovereign political group. By arresting them, it almost lessens their liability. That's my question. Why didn't they just knock them out?
Well, I think this is the behavior of any true and tried and tested democracy, which only reverts to the use of force when indeed it has no other alternative whatsoever. And therefore, this is why at times, unfortunately, they're obliged to revert to targeted assassination of terrorists who are in the process of carrying out terrorist activities.
I think the Israeli government has more patience and humanity than I do. Luciana, stay with us. We've got Carol on the line. Carol, welcome.
Hi, Beryl.
How are you?
believe me, while I don't feel good at all some of the remarks I'm hearing, if you ask me, they're too darn, excuse me, Israelis, too darn gentle.
That's what I just said to Luciano.
I will not be so gentle.
That's what I just said to Luciano.
And I
How do you mean that?
I want to point something out.
Yeah.
Well, if it means bombing and killing some of them, well, be it. Because they started to stir, excuse the dirt in the first place. So they have to expect some retaliation, right?
I would think so.
Well,
you know, yesterday was the 90th anniversary of the Battle of the Somme, where for no land and no aggression against Canada, 24,000 Canadian boys lost their lives in a couple of days. And Israel doesn't have the right to whack a neighboring government that has launched 1,000 rockets against it?
Exactly.
They have to go and politely arrest these guys?
And also, I want to point out that it's related to Canada here. It was Canada Day yesterday. I was very angry at what I didn't see. Usually we're angry at what we see, but I was angry at what we didn't see. I was all dressed with my colors, white and red. I have my flag still on the balcony, my Canada flag, but I went around in NDG, and those years before, there were more flags out there. And now, I'm not saying people don't put a flag out, they're not patriotic, this is not what I'm saying. But there was such a drop, and also there's the Mundial for Italy. It's all very nice to have Italian flags, but darn, guys, you were accepted here years and years ago. Put at least a little Canadian flag next to your flag.
Carol, hold the thought. We got to pay some bills. Luciano Del Negro, Executive Director of the Quebec Israel Committee, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. And email iapm.ca with about her views on Canada, and she's a little disappointed and a little angry about what's happening in the Middle East as far as Israel not being understood. And we have on the line as well Luciano Del Negro, Executive Director of the Quebec Israel Committee. Carol, you were saying you didn't see enough Canadian flags. Everybody was into the World Cup.
No, I was angry because I figured, heck, I mean, okay, I'm not forcing everybody to put a flag on Canada Day, but darn, I say, it went down so much with the other years. I've never seen it. It's the first time I see this in my life.
Carol, part of the problem, we were talking about it with Andrew Cohen earlier on, and it fits into this discussion of Israel. I mean, you have countries that understand what freedom's about. You have countries that understand, and I know you and I have talked before about the countries that are the price that our fathers have paid for freedom. And then, unfortunately, Canada may be going down a slippery slope to not understanding real priorities over just entertainment. Carol, thanks very much for calling.
Thank you.
Thank you. Luciano.
Yes.
So you see, I'm not the only one who thinks that Israel's being too moderate. There was Carol, who was just, you know, fit to be tied.
Well, look, Israel, this was foisted upon Israel. We pray for Gilad Shalit's safe return. I'd like to say that the real collective punishment being directed at Palestinians derives from its own leadership that is holding its population hostage to a destructive agenda that allows no room for peace with or acceptance of Israel. And it's a very ominous sign to Israel and to the international community what Hamas is presently doing.
And that is the sad truth, and we hope the chattering classes get it. Luciano Del Negro, Executive Director of the Quebec Israel Committee, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Good day.
Well, you know, countries have priorities, and sometimes those priorities are forced on them. And sometimes countries don't understand how good they have it, and they don't understand how to attack the real political and distributive issues that remain. So politicians in those countries get away with coming up with all kinds of schemes to make the electoral think that they're doing something when they're really not. And that, too, unfortunately, is part of the Canadian mindset of buying into schemes that are just whimsical at best and destructive at worst. And one policy package that Canadians have bought into, and particularly that has been bought into Quebec, is the whole Kyoto Protocol, carbon taxes as a kind of serious way of reducing greenhouse emissions and helping the environment. Our next guest says that's not true. Now, we've examined that before, but there are few voices as authoritative as that of Jack Mintz, President and CEO of the C.D. Howe Institute. Jack Mintz, thanks for taking the time in the Sunday to join us.
My pleasure.
Jack, Quebec's in love with Kyoto. Quebec's in love with carbon taxes. As you wrote in a recent paper, Canada's emissions are actually 25% above 1990 levels, double that of the United States. We're paying $1.3 billion to Russia for tax credits, to buy their tax credits in order to pollute, and all of a sudden the Quebec government is putting in a carbon tax that it assures voters will not be passed on by the companies to the population. Now, how silly is this?
Well, actually, I would say the carbon tax concept in Quebec is more of a tax grab than it is environmental policy. It's really trying to argue for a way of the government trying to raise some more revenue on something different than what people normally think about. But it's really not going to do that much when it comes to reducing carbon emissions.
In other words, in addition to the Quebec government saying that despite the federal cut in the GST, they're going to lop on a 1% tax on gas, this is yet another way to get money.
No, that's exactly right, because you know people consume gasoline to drive their cars and trucks and everything else, and they also consume heating fuel in order to heat their homes. And it's a lot more than about carbon. And if the attempt is to really cut emissions that are caused by these various products, then really what one wants to do is control the emissions, not the product themselves.
And I was you anticipated my next question. What I want to speak with you about right after this break is part of what you wrote in your op-ed this past week. If governments are to be serious about reducing greenhouse gases, they need to look for more effective policies surgically directed at emissions rather than using blunt instruments. And we're going to talk to Jack Mintz, President and CEO of the CDIL Institute, about those surgical possibilities right after this. Montreal, we're back, and our very, very special guest, we're very pleased to have him, is Jack Mintz, President and CEO of the CDIL Institute, one of the most authoritative voices in Canada on how public policy and economics really work, and how sometimes politicians' ideas just, and the public still picks up on silly stuff. And today we're talking about carbon taxes in Kyoto. Jack, governments, if they're going to be serious about reducing greenhouse emissions, need policies at emissions. Define one for us, please.
Well, basically, these would be policies that really try to limit the emissions as opposed to the consumption of the product.
Would that be something on the order of a government's encouraging through tax credits or the like, the importation of hybrid cars or the manufacture of hybrid cars?
Things like regulations on hybrid cars, the use of ethanol, which has been controversial because of the amount of natural gas and energy that has to go into the production of ethanol, but recent studies does show there is a net gain in reducing emissions. I think a really good example is clean coal, where one can eliminate a lot of the NOxes and SOxes associated with coal. And there's a project right now by Encana in Saskatchewan where they're sequestering carbon dioxide coming from coal and then putting it back into the ground to push out more energy coming out of the ground in a very lucrative manner.
And, yes, we had Gwyn Morgan on that a few weeks ago.
Yes, that's right. So this is a kind of policy that works very well, and I think if policies are directed at trying to deal with emissions as opposed to the consumption of products, then really there'll be a role for oil and natural gas and coal in the future in the world, but it might be those products without many emissions that might cause greenhouse gases and harming the environment.
How do we attack the acceptance by so many Canadians of things like carbon taxes in Kyoto? The evidence is there, the facts are there, that if every country that signed Kyoto, for example, tomorrow satisfied it by 100%, the effect would be 0.1%. You've got politicians from Stephen Dion all the way down, every green politician saying it's really not going to affect anything. What is it going to take to make Canadians understand that these are just Potemkin village policies, Kyoto and carbon taxes particularly?
I don't know. It's a bit unfortunate because back in 1997, when the Prime Minister ran to Kyoto and signed on the target of reducing greenhouse gases in Canada by 6% relative to 1990 levels, there was not a shred of study that was going on in the federal government to know exactly what that would mean to the economy. The Australians did a lot of work, the Americans did a lot of work, and they made sure that they understood what a target might mean. In fact, Australia insisted on having higher emission levels, not lower ones, compared to the 1990 levels.
And yet they didn't sign on, but their emissions levels are better than ours.
Exactly, and you know, I think it's rather sad that Canada, who has to criticize the United States as our Prime Minister did during the last election, criticizing that, you know, the U.S. didn't sign Kyoto, and here we are. We may have signed an agreement, but we're not dealing with it very well. And of course, one might have some different views about the importance of greenhouse gases in affecting climate change because of, you know, the role that solar changes in the sun itself can cause some of these warming trends as well.
But I think
there is some value, I think, in moving ahead with trying to reduce greenhouse gases, but it's going to take much, much longer than what the Kyoto plan has, and we really do need a better plan and a better agreement.
Jack Mintz, please stay with us. We'll be back right after this. Talking to Jack Mintz of the C.D. Howe Institute, I should ask you one last question that's more tactical than strategic.
Sure.
Individuals like you, you particularly, but institutes like the C.D. Howe speak with such authority. Yet they don't want to engage in a lot of the brutal public debate of slamming Canadians' faces into the reality of what government policies are about. Now, on things like carbon taxes and Kyoto, why have we not heard a message, not just from C.D. Howe, but from a lot of other centers of influence and intelligence, that, hey, Canada, we're writing a $1.3 billion check to Russia this year to buy their emissions credits because their economy is going through the toilet, so they've reached their levels. This is a scam. We don't put it in that kind of layman's language, so all the public sees are these tree huggers. How do we reverse that trend, or can we reverse that trend?
Well, I'm not so sure. I think, first of all, for an institute like ours, we try to, set the parameters of the debate, and we want all sides to listen to us. And so, we're not very good at mudslinging because that sort of puts many people off from listening to us if we did engage in that sort of thing.
Nah, politics is just as fun as policy, isn't it, Jack?
Well, we're particularly careful about not being too political.
Not because, partisanship.
You know,
politics in terms of taking the word on the street.
Right. But we do go after a number of things, and I think what I found what's worked most effectively is when we're able to put out some information that many other groups can use to allow them to argue their cases whatever way they wish. And that I think we have done in terms of, for example, our discussion of tax policy, where we've had a lot of influence on a lot of the debate. And in fact, the policies that we've advocated have been going through. So if my article on carbon taxation and the criticism of the Quebec carbon tax has some impact and maybe getting people to rethink some of that, then I think that would be great.
It is great, but there aren't many Jack Mintzes in Canada, and we thank you for spending some time with us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's Kyoto and carbon taxes, which is one part of the problem of our public acceptance of just information from government, laws from government that don't work. But another more insidious piece of legislation and legislative proposal, has reared its ugly head again. And this is called, and God knows where George Orwell is when you need him, the Modernization of Investigative Techniques Act. This is the resurrection of a liberal proposal that died on the order papers to force internet telephony and email providers to keep all our information on their hard drives and turn them over at simple request of government, thousands of files at a time, thousands of people at a time. Your information, your email, your telephone calls. Just a simple request. To discuss the pitfalls of this, we're joined by University of Ottawa Law Professor Michael Geist. Michael, thank you for taking the time to be with us.
Sure, happy to do it.
Does it sometimes strike you that both the Liberals and the Conservatives, and we talked earlier with Andrew Cohen of Carleton about how this Prime Minister is trying to give Canadians a new sense of purpose and vision, but sometimes it strikes me that both Liberals and Conservatives use the justice agenda as a throwaway to the right wing. What kind of minds can concoct something like this?
Well, I think that's a fair point. And certainly one might have hoped that had, with the previous liberal attempt to put in so-called lawful access legislation dying on the order paper, that there was a chance to rethink. But there's been every indication that this government intends to move forward. In fact, the scuttlebutt around Ottawa is that they're going to even move forward in a harder fashion than did the Liberals by actually pouring in millions of dollars into the initiative.
Remarkable. Now, this would work, literally, it would not require probable cause, as I understand it, at least the original Liberal bill. It would simply require a simple request from state security authorities.
Well, it raised several issues. On the one hand, it really required Canadian Internet service providers to really reshape the way the Internet functions in Canada by building in new surveillance capabilities directly into the network, literally hardwiring the network. And the notion was that that would take about 3 years to happen. The largest ISPs would do it as they upgrade their technology, although amazingly, there was this exception for Internet service providers with under 100,000 subscribers. So if this is really designed to deal with terrorists, it's as if terrorists couldn't understand that if they went to a small ISP to transmit their messaging, they actually wouldn't be caught by some of these technologies.
Or use their own servers. What's the big deal?
Right. No, it was, there were enough loopholes there that it made it rather silly to claim that this would make a significant dent in dealing with terrorist-related monitoring.
So this was just something that sounded good to the public, and I want to get to that, because at the same time there was a companion piece of legislation back before the last election. I hope that doesn't rear its head. Michael, stay with us. You're going to pay a bill and come right back to you. Back, and we're pleased to be joined by University of Ottawa Law Professor Martin with the new Internet Bill, the Modernization of Investigative Techniques Act, which will allow the federal government to have access to all our Internet telephony and phone records on simple request. And Michael was just explaining to us that there is an exemption for ISP providers of under 100,000 subscribers, Michael?
Yeah, that was the last Liberal proposal, indeed.
Now, how difficult would it be for terror groups to make their own servers or to make their own, or to just switch? What's the statute of security justification for something like this?
Well, there isn't really a national security justification for it. It's more of a cost issue. And so there's a recognition that at least the sense is a recognition that it's expensive, obviously, to look to ISPs to change their system so that they can engage in this greater level of surveillance. And while the large operators were in a position to do so, or at least do so over time, some of the smaller ISPs probably couldn't survive if they were forced to change all their equipment. But of course, you have to make a choice. If the argument is that this is essential for security purposes, well, then it's essential. If it's not, then why are we doing it in the first place?
What made me laugh about this proposal, what made me think that it's just another piece of palaver that the elected officials can throw into their flyers of the next election when the Liberals came up with it, is the fact that we've had, through the communication security establishment, as you know, a quarter of our hardline calls monitored, half our cell phones, all our landline calls, then they're filtered for code words, but we don't have the money to transcribe them, so 20% of all these calls are sent to the National Security Agency in Washington for transcription. Where the hell are we going to get a bureaucracy to even look at this, even if this was a valid legislative measure, which I don't believe it is because it infringes privacy rights?
Yeah, no, I don't think it's valid either. I mean, and frankly, some people are pointing to the recent series of arrests in Toronto to argue that, well, you see, we need these kinds of protections, but I'd actually argue that the series of arrests that we saw actually point to the fact that there are already laws on the books that provide law enforcement with the powers they need to investigate where necessary. And the one thing we really haven't heard from law enforcement, other than the notion that this would make their life a little bit easier, is where the current law falls short and why it is we need some significantly invasive new provisions.
And every person in law enforcement and security that we've talked to and at the Institute, we work with many, have actually told me, let the government spend money, not on this kind of stuff, not on mandatory minimums, give us personnel to put out in the field. We don't need any more analysts listening and reading. We need personnel for the hard intelligence. And as you made the point recently, that the arrest of the 17 men in Toronto was done by field work.
Yep.
And we don't have enough people or enough budgets for operatives.
No, I think that's a fair point. And the notion that we would be building this kind of surveillance into our network, and then moreover, as you pointed out up at the very top, permitting law enforcement in some instances licenses to request subscriber information without any judicial oversight whatsoever. Literally, on the basis of a phone call on a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week basis, there would be a requirement for some ISPs to provide some basic subscriber information within 30 minutes. No oversight at all. So we're increasing or proposing to increase the amount of surveillance, but at the same time decreasing the amount of oversight that we put into the system.
Now, this is what I meant by the a companion piece of legislation that was being talked about in November when this first was proposed, again proposed by the former Liberal Justice Minister, who had a great reputation as a civil libertarian before he went into politics. That law was the companion legislation to the, I was about to say legalization, which I would like to see, but the decriminalization of marijuana. So on the one hand, the proposal was to decriminalize marijuana, but on the other hand, you were allowed to stop people on the roads without probable cause. Again, you didn't have to be weaving or anything, just to check for drugs. And then there was yet another piece of legislation that was proposed where persons of interest, as the law was called, would be subject to electronic anklets, if they weren't Canadian citizens, on simple calls or not even evidence, on a simple perceived threat by somebody in executive authority.
Mm-hmm.
Where is our country going on this Canada Day weekend? You know, this is an appropriate question to ask. Where is our country going in terms of the quality of our justice?
Well, it's discouraging, and certainly the particular provisions we're talking about are very discouraging. And one of the things that I always find curious is the real disconnect between the public on the one hand, who any time is made aware of some of these proposals, really, you know, gets up in arms, expressing some real concern about some of these proposals. Yet, for whatever reason, it seems that policymakers now from all parties are willing to plunge ahead without any real strong evidence that there's a need to do so.
And that's the frightening thing. They're all piling onto this.
Yep.
In America, they'd be going nuts over this. There'd be people marching in New York from New York to San Francisco.
Well, in fairness, some of these provisions are already in place in the United States. I mean, the U.S. is not exactly the best place to point to.
No. But now that it's coming out that they're in place, there's at least demonstrable anger at it. I've heard nothing across Canada since last November when these were suggested.
Yeah, no, that's true. Things have been quiet of late. But, you know, listen, in the U.S., people are only beginning to become aware, it seems like, about the kind of surveillance that has been taking place there, whether it's phone calls or otherwise. And if anything, that I think should give us pause here in Canada to recognize that once you build this into the system, it's very difficult to undo.
That's right.
And the potential for abuse is unquestionably there.
Government never gives up power or taxes. Michael Geist, I thank you for spending some time with us. We will be talking again as this develops.
My pleasure.
And Montreal, good Canada weekend to you. Remember what you are as Canadians. You're sovereign to your government. Thanks to Chris Smith, Val Prudnikoff. We'll see you next time.